Researchers at the University of Arkansas are looking into the ways climate change threatens our country and the world's fruit and vegetable supplies. The team is led by researchers from the University of Florida and the ILSI Research Foundation, and also includes researchers from the International Food Policy Research Institute, the University of Illinois, Washington State University, and the World Agricultural Economics and Environmental Services. Marty Matlock, the executive director of the U of A Resiliency Center and professor of ecological engineering, is part of the project, and recently he talked with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek.
So you and a team of other researchers are looking at how climate change will impact the growing of fruits and vegetables in the U.S. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you're looking at?
We grow things where we grow them because they grow well there. They grow well there because we have enough rain, enough sunlight, enough frost-free days, and low enough pest pressures so that we can grow them economically and so that they're functional products. Our problem with climate change is the places that used to be good to grow things are no longer going to be good to grow things. And it may be that temperatures are fine, but water's not there anymore. Or it may be that there's too much water there now and therefore too increased pests or increased disease pressure. So we're evaluating the probable impacts of climate change across the United States on where we currently grow a portfolio of fruits and vegetables to see how climate-changing conditions will impact our ability to continue to grow them. We'll be using risk assessment. We'll be using life cycle assessment, all integrated with climate change models and physiological crop growth models.
So can you give me an example of a place that's was a great place to grow something at one point, and now it's sort of on the decline?
Strawberries in California. Many of our strawberries, if not most of our U.S.-grown strawberries, came out of the Central Valley of California, continue to. We've had a couple of things that are happening that are preventing that. Methylbromide is no longer being allowed to be used as a fungicide. That's part of the Montreal Accord for ozone protection, way back when, under the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. So the ban kicked in about 3 years ago for methylbromide. So now we have fungus impacts or fungus pressures on those strawberries. There's no real replacement for that. So there's a pest pressure. And we also have, since we're all pretty familiar with California's drought problem, the fact that they just don't have enough water to meet their increasing urban demand as well as their ecological demand and agronomic demands. So something has to give, and it's usually agronomic demand gives first. Take it from agriculture first. Crops don't vote. And so that's been one of the challenges. So we're going to have to find another place to grow strawberries. University of Arkansas led an initiative with the Walmart Foundation, Kurt Rahm in our horticulture department, and the Center for Ag and Rural Sustainability led a research program, for example, looking at places where we could expand strawberry production across the United States. And we discovered that we could effectively grow strawberries using advanced technologies like high tunnels and greenhouses in North Dakota just fine. Not as profitably as California, but profitably enough. So that's the sort of example of how we can use knowledge of the system and advancing technologies to identify alternatives for production.
Given the change in the climate, are there going to be places that become able to grow stuff that haven't been able to grow stuff before? Is that a possibility?
Or absolutely. What we understand from our predictions of climate change is that we will have hotter hots, colder colds, wetter wets, and drier dries. Hotter hots means that we will probably see an expanding growing season, frost-free days, across the central part of the United States. We're already seeing it now. We're planting
Definitely.
Earlier and earlier every year. Flowers are blooming earlier and earlier every
yeah.
year. So that all indicates that we're getting longer growing seasons. Those longer growing seasons make possible the production of a fruit and vegetable crop that we couldn't produce before. It takes can take up to 150 days to produce some vegetable crops. It's 160 days to produce corn. So you have to have a pretty long growing season to produce many of these things. Some of them are very sensitive, especially you think about peach trees, very sensitive to frost. And we have this problem this year in Arkansas. We lost much of our peach production because we had a late season frost. If we can expand that growing season, then we can start growing things further and further north. And interestingly enough, we often have less pest pressure as we move further and further north because they get really cold in the wintertime.
Right.
The challenge we have in the south is we don't get cold enough to kill many of the pests, many of the diseases that infect these crops.
And is that going to continue to be a problem in in the South as it gets warmer because these pests are just going to keep multiplying?
Expansion of disease, crop diseases, which are bacterial, fungal in nature and viral in nature, and the expansion of insect pests is a major problem. We're seeing it in our conventional crops. We also will see it expanding in our fruit and vegetable crops. Yes, we have our orange crops are being decimated right now by a virus that we had not seen before in the United States that's showing up. Part of this is a result of just global trade and movement of materials around the world. So isolated diseases are now being spread everywhere. But part of it's because these diseases can now persist here, whereas before we had weather conditions that would usually limit their growth.
As far as farmers are concerned, obviously they're going to have to adjust quite a bit and sort of look long term. What are sort of the adjustments that farmers are going to have to make?
What this represents is not necessarily a transformation of the existing producers. They will continue to produce generally how they're producing because these changes are occurring slowly, incrementally. We're seeing that. We have extreme events, and then we go back to normal for a while, then an extreme event. So that increases the current risk of production. What we're looking at is transformation over decades, 20 to 50 years, what's going to happen. And what this means is opportunities for new producers. The next generation of growers won't be just looking at soybeans and corn in Iowa. They'll be looking at soybeans, corn, tomatoes, broccoli, and maybe apples in Iowa. And so now we see an expansion of the portfolio of opportunities for producers. It's really a good opportunity, a wonderful opportunity for small-scale production. Small-scale intensive production can introduce or allow new farmers to enter the market, enter production that are currently don't have access to adequate finance or land resources to produce. So for someone who's in their teens now, in 20 years, they could easily be growing 50 acres of mixed greens under glass and doing it quite profitably.
And, you know, obviously we want to be ahead of the climate change, not catching up to it. Are we ahead of it or are we playing kind of catch up?
How do you get ahead of something you can't see? We have a fairly clear understanding of our long-term 50-year probable trends. What it looks like plotting out incremental changes is not easy because these changes are not happening linearly. If I say that with a 2 degrees Celsius increase of Earth's atmospheric temperatures, we're going to see these changes in rainfall across Arkansas, I can't tell you when those are going to occur because they don't occur linearly. They often occur in a threshold event. Everything kind of goes normal with a few weird things, then suddenly everything changes. And that's what scientists have been saying for 50 years. These are nonlinear changes, nonlinear systems. And when they change rapidly and sometimes catastrophically, and irreversibly. So we're behind the curve because we are denying across many sectors of our community, we're denying the reality of our world. And there's no way you can make plans and adapt when major segments of your population just don't even believe the change is happening.
So has that been a challenge to making some of these changes?
It's only a challenge insofar as investment opportunities, that is the finance community and other and producers maybe don't see the opportunities yet. But again, the changes are happening slow enough that those adaptations are occurring now. What drove this home to most agricultural producers was the catastrophic drought in California over the last decade. They're doing a lot better now, but they also know that it just takes two more bad years and they're back in drought.
Mm-hmm.
And so this notion that the California water problem is over because they had a wet year, hydrologists know that's just not the case.
Yeah.
Farmers know that's just not the case. California producers have already made irreversible changes, removing almond groves, for example, that take 15 years to get into full productivity, and they've just removed them, walnut groves, because they couldn't water them and move to other crops. Arkansas is now one of the major rice-producing states in the nation. Used to be California.
Huh.
Not anymore. They still produce. They're number two still, the northern part, north central part of California. Yeah. But we're number one now in terms of total volume produced.
Yeah.
And that's happened because of the drought, among other things. So changes are occurring. Farmers adapt. Farmers have always adapted.
So let's talk about climate change denial. And what can you do? I mean, is there something you can do to convince people?
The difficulty of convincing people of something they've never seen is they've never seen it before. The level of climate change that we are experiencing and anticipating that we will experience is unprecedented in human history. It's not unprecedented in Earth's history. The intensity of it is unprecedented, but Earth has gone through cycles like this before, and lots of species went extinct during those cycles. So people like to say, well, this is not new to Earth's history. No, but it's new to the human experience, and there's something we can do about it. Mm-hmm. You can't do much about volcanoes or asteroids, but you can do something about carbon emissions and increasing carbon in the atmosphere from carbon cycling from human activities and other greenhouse gases. So the challenge we have is that scientists are incredibly good at understanding complex systems and incredibly bad at communicating them. And then when we do communicate them, we tend to polarize listeners because we tend to entangle our science with other belief structures, mm-hmm. other attitudes. So we struggle with how we can communicate effectively. Those who would use political motives to deny science that's not a redeemable mm-hmm. Characteristic that I care to engage in. But there are many folks of very goodwill and good intentions and good ethics who just don't understand this process. We have to be better at explaining it, at demonstrating it, and at characterizing what we can do about it, the consequences mm-hmm. too. The really good news is that federal government policies really aren't driving the improvements we're making around mm-hmm. the country, around this continent with greenhouse gas emissions. Citizens and corporations are. So we don't need the government to lead us mm-hmm. in this area. We're doing just fine, thank you very much. The government's just trying to catch up. Though government policies and common investments can help. So that's another opportunity we see. So as we move this science of agricultural production forward, we're going to have USDA policies that understand and adapt to the risk and provide farmers with risk management tools and provide alternative production strategies for these farmers as these opportunities expand. If we don't have that, then that's a policy failure, and that will limit our ability to adapt. Resilience, the ability to adapt to change and to recover from impacts, that resilience is the key. That's what we're trying mm-hmm. to build into the system. That resilience makes our communities better, makes our families better, makes us better as a nation. It's hard to say that's not a common value of our country. So if we can find those things we agree on and move those forward, that's one way we can stop being frustrated about being right and ineffective. That's one way we can move to being right and effective.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by our studios. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That was Marty Matlock, the Executive Director of the University of Arkansas Resiliency Center and Professor of Ecological Engineering. The project he and a team of researchers from around the country and the world are working on is supported by a $3 million grant from the United States Department of Agriculture National Institute of Food and Agriculture. This is Ozarks at Large.